This is the story of the one. As a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility, he knows keeping the line up and running is a top priority. That's why he chooses Grainger. Because when a drive belt gets damaged, Grainger makes it easy to find the exact specs for the replacement product he needs. And next day delivery helps ensure he'll have everything in place and running like clockwork. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
Stuffing, for instance. I'd much rather put a lot more effort into the stuffing and enjoy it.
And this is the big cavity, and then there's a neck cavity, too, right here. That is much smaller. And you can put a little bit of stuffing there.
I think you and I make very good dressing.
Yes.
It's the holiday time. Some people call it stuffing.
Yeah, so that's the war right there. You got the lines are drawn between stuffing and dressing. And I stand firmly on the side of Gordon Ramsay and Martha Stewart with their stuffing. And joining us now, my buddy in the morning, Brian Wilson, who stands with Paula Deen in this whole dressing situation. Good morning and happy Thanksgiving, Brian Wilson.
Gobble, gobble to you and to Francis as well. Good morning.
Good morning. You're in the kitchen. I can hear the reflective surfaces. You are actually in your kitchen right now, aren't you?
Well, I have, since I was with you last, I've been on a number of planes, and I now stand in my sister's newly remodeled kitchen in Canyon, Texas, where we are in the process, even as I speak, of beginning to make the cornbread dressing, which is a tradition in my family that's been handed down from generation to generation to generation. I stand
Really? Four generations of Wilsons have been making cornbread dressing? Really?
Well, it's either that or the recipe was stolen from my sister's mother-in-law. But I mean, it's a topic of much debate in our family. And if anybody who suggests that I stole this recipe, those are scurrilous lies, and I roundly deny those charges.
Now, Brian, when Larry mentions Paula Deen, it makes me think that this whole debate is geographical. Because when I think, I'm from Pennsylvania originally, and when I think of dressing a turkey, it involves a shirt or a sport coat or something like that.
For those who don't know, dressing is a type of a food that is made outside the bird. It is made in a pan separate and apart from the bird. It's not put inside the bird, although I have heard that some people put some dressing inside the bird. But this, in my experience, it's something that's made separate and apart from the bird.
Wait, but if they put the dressing in the bird, aren't they, in fact, stuffing the bird with dressing, stuffing?
They are stuffing the bird with dressing.
So do you have stuffing, too? Or just dressing?
No. Look, let me just say this, that over the years...
Do you hear the frustration in his voice?
It's driving him nuts!
We have made dressing for people who are, have always grown up only with stuffing. And they said, well, we don't know about this cornbread dressing. You need to trust us. Okay, well, okay. I mean, it's a challenge for a lot of people to be open to new ideas like Larry. I know it's hard for some people. But when we make the cornbread dressing for them the very first time after they've had a lifetime full of stuffing, well, once you go cornbread dressing, you can never go back.
I've heard a variation of that.
The undertone that I hear in his voice, and I just know Brian from listening to him on the program with you, Larry, but the undertone that I hear in his voice is, you Yankee dummies, don't you know anything? Why do I have to explain this to you morons?
Absolutely, basically. Brian, may I say, Brian, you've been in the Lone Star State for a good 7 hours now, and you sound like... you've been there for 40 years.
Isn't that funny how that happens?
You are more Texan than I've ever heard. All right, so let's cut to the chase. And by the way, we want to hear you from you, 888-630-9625. You can chime in on the eternal debate between dressing and stuffing. Excuse me, cornbread dressing and stuffing, what the rest of us normal Americans eat. But also, what is your favorite dish on the table? Is anyone actually vote for turkey here? I would love to hear from you, because turkey always seems to be like on the bottom of the list, like eighth, ninth place. What else else is your prime dish on the table today? 888-630-WMAL. All right, Brian, it's the moment we've all been waiting for. We need to hear this recipe, the Brian Wilson cornbread dressing recipe.
Well, let me tell you, this. I have been an ambassador for cornbread dressing for many, many years, as people know.
Sure. It comes. He wears a uniform. There's epaulets and a whole.
I'll address him as Mr. Ambassador.
Yes, Mr. Ambassador.
Well, you know, you're the crab cake czar. I'm the cornbread dressing ambassador.
All right.
Listen, if you want to just find this recipe, I can make it very simple for you. Just go to Google and go Brian Wilson cornbread dressing. You know, it's the first thing that'll pop up. Here you go. You got to make cornbread first of all. Usually you make it the night before. Now, if you do not have a good family recipe for cornbread, which we do, my mom was the world champion cornbread maker. Well, then just, you know, any kind of cornbread mix would be just fine. Then you take one package of herbal stuffing, you know, the stuff like Stouffer's Pepperidge Farm.
He's making it out of a box.
And by the way, a box of stuffing. You can't make your eternally glorious dressing without actually using stuffing?
No, you can. I'm trying to help people out because they probably don't have time to make biscuits and white bread and that kind of stuff.
Oh, he's just trying to help people out, Larry.
I see. All right.
He's doing us all a favor.
He's a giver.
I'm giving you the shortcut here. Okay, then you take one onion and you chop it. You take 1 to 2 celery stalks and you chop it.
All right.
Then you take 3 eggs and you put it in the mix.
Mm.
Then you get a large can of chicken broth. I mean, this is just the simple way to do this. Okay, then you start with crumbling up the cornbread. Uh-huh. And that's where we are right now. I stand now. I'm looking at a gigantic pan.
Mm.
And I'm talking, okay, this is 24 by 12 pan of cornbread that has been crumbled.
All right.
I mean, you just mush it up with your hands.
Now, I got to think that's something the kids would have fun doing, right? Getting in there.
Yes. The annual crumbling of the cornbread. That's right.
All in capital letters because it's a very esteemed event.
Is there any bourbon involved in this process?
No, it helps by the end of the day when there are a lot of little kids around. But other than that,
all right.
Then you take the stuff, the little package of herbal stuffing, you dump it in, you chop up the onion, and you chop up the celery. You add a little seasoning to taste. You know, maybe you want to put some sage in there if you want to. I don't know. Then you take the can of chicken broth and you pour it in. And you start mushing this all up together with your hands. This is going to get nasty and it's going to get ugly, but you really want to make it all about the consistency of thick oatmeal. And then you put it in the pan.
This sounds fantastic.
You put it in the pan and you cook it for about an hour. To an hour and a half at 400 degrees. And then, my friends, when it comes out, you have a beautiful golden yellow pan of cornbread dressing. You take it, you scoop it, you put it next to the turkey, you put some giblet gravy over it, and, my God, you will never, ever have anything better in your life.
There it is. All right, Brian Wilson, happy Thanksgiving, my friend. It sounds it does sound really good. I would not have it in place of stuffing.
Right.
I would have it as it's a nice accoutrement.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nice little side dish to the stuffing. But and also, can I just raise one other challenge to you quickly, Brian, because you know the clock.
Yes.
You know what time it is. There's no meat in that dish. How can a true Texan celebrate a dish that has no meat?
Well, you know, the meat is the turkey, and the turkey goes alongside. In fact, here in Texas, we don't say turkey and dressing. We say dressing and turkey.
All right. Brian Wilson, happy Thanksgiving. Grateful for your friendship, my friend.
Yes, thanks. And y'all have a great Thanksgiving. Gobble, gobble, everybody.
Thanks, Brian. All y'all have one, too.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
I'm Larry O'Connor alongside Brian Wilson.
And joining us now, right now, is Bill Crystal, the editor of the Weekly Standard, good friend of this program. Good morning to you, Bill. How are you?
I'm fine. Hey, you're having Larry Kudlow on. Encourage him to run for Senate in Connecticut.
We keep asking.
He's being very coy about it, Bill.
No, but I just push him. You know, when you guys talk, he'll listen.
Yeah.
You know, I talk to him and he just sloughs it off. But when he gets the heavyweights, weighing in. I think that'll
We are kingmakers here, yeah, Bill Kristol. Right. It's true. Yeah. Thank you for identifying. Well,
and thank you very much for that, Bill. We appreciate
it. The check's in the mail.
Hey, listen, I want to talk to you about this meeting that's going to take place today between two presidents, President François Hollande from France, who's just his country's just gone through this horrible attack, and President Obama. They're going to talk about the war on ISIS, and according to some of the advanced reporting that I've seen on it, it suggests that President Hollande is coming here with one message for President Obama. This is an emergency. And one gets the sense that our current president doesn't quite look at it the same way that President Hollande does.
Yeah, who would have thought 10 years ago that France would be urging us to get more serious about fighting the war on terror, to be more aggressive in our bombing, to consider even using ground troops. It does remind one that we are the indispensable nation in terms of these fights. You know, France has limited resources, and they can be try to be as tough as they want. They've got their hands full with stuff at home also. They just don't have a military that can do the kinds of things our military can do. So, you know, American leaders can try to withdraw from the world, and, I think we see the terrible consequences of that in the Middle East and now in Europe, and hopefully not here, but God knows. And secondly, it doesn't do much good to do what a lot of American politicians like to do, which say, well, we need to have a big coalition, you know, and the Sunni Arabs and the French and NATO and Europeans and this and that, and that's all fine, and of course we should work with our allies and use them to help us, but if we don't lead, nothing fundamental is going to happen.
Well, and Bill Kristol, if I can sort of take that and stretch it into our 2016 presidential decision, because here we are 10 days after this attack in Paris, and I think on the minds of most Americans, especially finding yesterday the State Department issues a global travel warning for all Americans, this is first and foremost in our minds. It will be the topic of conversation at our Thanksgiving table. So which candidates are presenting themselves in such a way that make them serious contenders for the new commander-in-chief and someone who might be able to lead that coalition?
I mean, I think you asked the question right, how are they presenting themselves? And really, they have a chance to make their case. None of them is automatically qualified for that. There's no Dwight D. Eisenhower in this race. There's no even Richard Nixon, a former vice president who's been in the Oval Office for many, many decisions, or a Dick Cheney or that type, right? It's two first-term senators and two people in the private sector, Trump and Carson, none of them really with experience managing national security.
Well, you have a former secretary of state and former senator.
A good point on the Democratic side, yes. But of course, so she has that advantage, and it could be an advantage in the next fall. She also has her fingerprints all over President Obama's foreign policy, which has led to this horrible situation. So it's pretty easy for the Republicans to turn to her and say, hey, we're having these travel warnings here 3 years after you left office as a result of policies you embraced. So I think that's a mixed blessing. So I think the four Republican leaders, and what's striking in the polls now is how much of a big four have emerged, Trump, Carson, Cruz, and Rubio. No one else, a new Quinnipiac poll in Iowa this morning, no one else above 5%. They're all in double digits, between 13 and about 25. So, you know, they really have a chance to make their case. History shows you don't have to have that huge amount of experience to be a good commander-in-chief. But they need to explain what they would do and what they wouldn't do. Cruz is moving up, and I think Carson's lost a little, maybe because of this commander-in-chief question. He's an admirable man. People like him. They respect him. Can you see him in the Oval Office getting the reports about, you know, an attack, a terror attack here and Putin doing this there, and be confident he would know exactly what to do, have the experience to know what to do? I think that hurts Carson. I think it probably helps the other, certainly Cruz and Rubio, who have been senators who have been active in foreign policy. Trump, a tough guy, so people who like him will think, well, he'll know what to do. So I think we're heading, I guess what I'm struck by is Cruz's strength. I think there'll be a certain conservative consolidation behind Cruz. And then I think there'll be a lot of pressure on Christie, Bush, Kasich donors and supporters to say, okay, your guy gets to, you know, keep trying for 2, 3, 4 more weeks. But at some point, if you're an establishment-type Republican, you're probably going to be pressuring them to consolidate behind Rubio.
So, Bill Kristol, speaking of donors, supporters, and the establishment, what do you make of this narrative this week that there are various super PACs and organizations affiliated with or controlled by people who had worked for the RNC or for establishment Republicans who are all sort of independently on their own going after Donald Trump? And Donald Trump is saying, listen, this is tantamount to the RNC not playing fair, which, of course, you remember is, you know, his rationale for staying on the ticket and not running third party. Regardless of that aspect, don't Republicans need the people who are voting for Donald Trump and supporting Donald Trump, regardless of whether he gets the nomination or not? Why go after him so hard?
Well, I think they want to make sure he doesn't become the nominee, which if he wins Iowa and then New Hampshire and then South Carolina, he could well be. So I think they're entitled to go after him. I would try to separate his supporters from him, not trash him and his supporters. I think that's the big distinction a lot of the establishment types make. You could be critical of Donald Trump, do it a little more in a tone of sorrow than anger, but also say, look, we understand the why people have been attracted to him, but here's what they need to know, and this is why they should now reconsider. That tone is quite different from saying you're an idiot if you've ever been attracted to anything Donald Trump says. So I think a lot depends on the way in which they go after Trump, and it could backfire. I mean, Trump could exploit this. He's trying to do it right now as kind of he's being victimized by the establishment ganging up on him.
Well, and look, it's not in Republicans' best interest, I would imagine, to have Trump say, I'm going to take my ball, I'm going to go over here, and I'm going to run as a third-party candidate, because doesn't that all but guarantee President Hillary?
Yeah, that was such a crazy year. Who knows? But I do think Trump is laying the predicate for if the establishment gangs up on him and he can present himself as losing kind of unfairly, being unfairly deprived of the nomination, I could see him thinking he would run third party. And I don't know. You know, Perot was ahead at one point of Bush and Clinton in 92. I was in the White House then. I remember it. I don't know. Is it inconceivable that Trump runs third party? Rubio's the nominee, and it looks sort of like the establishment ganged up to give it to this young guy who's, you know, not maybe isn't quite tough enough for the job. I mean, this is what Trump will say. And then there's Hillary on the Democratic side, who's part of Obama's foreign policy.
Yeah.
Could Trump make it a real three-way race? I don't want that, because I don't think Trump should be president. But analytically, I can't be sure that Trump doesn't have a third-party path.
Yeah.
Or that he wouldn't think he has one to the nomination.
Yeah, that's a good point.
The presidency.
Bill, because we only have a minute left, but at Weekly Standard Offices, are you guys kicking around the idea that this could be a contested ballot, considering the fact that all these early Republican primaries, the first 25 or so, are proportionally distributed? It's not winner-take-all?
Yeah, you could go to the convention with three or four candidates and no one having a clear 50%. The whole proportionality thing is complicated. A lot of these states are less proportional than you would think. You know, that if you win 40% of the vote, you'll probably get 60-70% of the delegates because of the way the rules work with thresholds,
yeah,
et cetera. But no, I think it's quite possible three or four could stay in and continue to split delegates pretty far. That would be kind of fun. Good for us.
For those of us who make a business of talking about and analyzing the political scene in America, that would be a fascinating time.
Well, Bill Kristol, editor of Weekly Standard, thank you so much for joining us. Always a pleasure.
Happy Thanksgiving, guys.
You too, Bill.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall, 5 to 9, Monday through Friday. The best of Mornings on the Mall.
If you're in a position to try and take the gunman down, to take the gunman out, it's the best option for saving lives before police can get there.
That was D.C. Police Chief Kathy Lanier last night on 60 Minutes. Today, at a meeting of the District of Columbia Council, Jack Evans chimed in.
I mean, if you want to tackle somebody, grab a baseball bat. I mean, there's a whole lot of litanies of ways to address that. Those guys on the train, they didn't have any guns, but they managed to take out a guy who did.
Grab a baseball bat. Grab a baseball bat. Delroy Burton is the president of the D.C. Police Union and joins us right now. All right, let's start there. Are the D.C. cops ready to arrive on the scene after citizens of the district have grabbed their baseball bats to take out a terrorist?
Well, I've never heard such a ridiculous thing coming from an elected leader, and I like Jack Evans. The fact of the matter is the guys on the train were fortunate that that man's weapons did not function like the way they were supposed to, and they were able to get to him before he could kill a lot of people. But my biggest concern with that advice coming from the chief of police is that we in the district, in the police department, the council, and the mayor have set up a scheme that makes it extremely difficult for citizens to follow the advice that the chief just gave.
Expand on that, please.
Well, it's difficult to get a permit for your gun, and it's more difficult to get a permit to carry that gun. So and I think it's sound advice that she's giving, by the way. I agree with her. But how are you going to take out a gunman like an Aaron Alexis? You can't do that with a baseball bat because he was actively shooting. You need weapons to take that person down.
Yeah.
And if, you know, we have a lot of restrictions about where you can have a gun in this town, and we make it difficult for people to be able to get licensed and carry those guns, So how are we going to allow citizens to now take on that gunman, that active shooter? There are only 45 concealed carry permits that have been issued in this city. That's not sufficient to deal with the potential problem of an active shooter.
And by the way, isn't Police Chief Kathy Lanier sort of the be-all and end-all on who gets approved for a permit? She actually does the final sign-off, and it's based on whether someone represents that they have a legitimate reason to exercise their Second Amendment rights.
Absolutely, Larry, and that's what was so shocking about what she said last night. That was absolutely the first time I've heard her say anything like that or indicate that there's been a shift in what we are telling people to do in an active shooter situation.
Wait a second. You're the president of the police union, and this is you first heard about this new policy on 60 Minutes. Hasn't she communicated this to the rank and file?
No, she hasn't communicated that to the rank and file. And you're right. She is the person who is the final arbiter as to who gets a weapon and a license to carry one. And they've made it very clear that they're hostile to issuing those licenses. And I'm not a Second Amendment, some people use the term zealot. I believe everybody has the right to carry a gun like the Constitution says or own one for self-protection. But they've made it extremely difficult for people to do that. And then to turn around and give the advice that, well, we want you to take out the shooter, it seems a bit hypocritical to me.
Now, how does it make it different for a cop to arrive on the scene? I mean, listen, we have incredibly trained police officers here in the District of Columbia. I've told my family members who are all freaking out and thinking, oh, my gosh, D.C. is going to get hit after Paris. I've let them know, listen, we have literally the best security and the best police officers at every level in this city, and we do. But how does it make it different for you to respond and your membership to respond to an event if, in fact, the citizenry might be responding as well? And I'm not saying they shouldn't, but does it change the mode of operation for you?
Well, it potentially could, but, one of the things that she said in their piece last night was that, for example, at the Navy Yard, within 6 minutes, all the people had been killed. So time is of the essence, and I think that's part of the point she was trying to make. In terms of the way we deal with an active shooter situation, everyone coming out of the building, everyone that we encounter, we have to assume they may be the active shooter until we determine that they're not. And so it adds a little bit to the mix in terms of what we have to do to clear people, but, again, the advice is good, but they haven't made it possible for people.
They got to loosen up the eggs. Delroy Burton is our guest. We only got a minute left. I got to ask you, as the head of the D.C. Police Union, in general, let's take this out of the realm of terrorism.
Okay.
In general, in Washington, D.C., which has seen an uptick in crime, uptick in homicides, there was a poll last week of Washingtonians. Their number one concern is crime. Would crime be better, and would the cops' jobs be, I don't want to use the word easier, but I'll just leave it where I was. Would crime be better in Washington, D.C. if more citizens could defend themselves legally, or forget about defending themselves, if they could just carry legal firearms like any other place in the country?
Potentially. I mean, I can't point to any studies that say that, but the potential is there for that. And I think, people who follow the rules shouldn't be penalized because they follow the rules. And that's the bottom line. And the way the mayor and the city council have gone about the whole issue of dealing with firearms has been punitive towards people who follow the rules. And the people who are breaking the rules, they seem to have free rein right now.
Delroy Burton, always good to have you, sir. Thank you very much for joining us on this.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. Now, more of the best of Mornings on the Mall.
It's official. Merry Christmas. I want to hear it from anyone else now. All these people screaming, oh, you're pushing it. No, Thanksgiving's over. It's Christmas time.
It's perfectly fine.
Exactly. We're flipping to all Christmas music format here on WMAL. We're not doing that. I'm so sorry. Apologize. Larry O'Connor here. It's Mornings on the Mall with Brian and Larry, 8:08 in the morning. And joining us is Francis Rose, sitting in for Brian Wilson, who's on vacation.
Nice to be here.
Good to have you, Francis.
Thank you.
And we talked about this a little bit yesterday. We embrace Christmas. We're excited that now there's no complaint. Why is it just because Santa Claus shows up at the end of a parade, suddenly it's okay to start saying Merry Christmas?
It's just what turns people on, Larry.
And I'm thrilled about it. People are also turned on by Christmas stories. This is a time where traditionally people like to sit around and read stories with their families and with their kids. And joining us right now is author Jonathan Last, who, well, he's sort of preying on that in a very crass commercial way. He's got a brand new book full of Christmas tales that you're going to want to buy. It's called The Christmas Virtues, A Treasury of Conservative Tales for the Holidays. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for being here. Thanks for having me. Merry Christmas to both of you. Now that we can say it, right? You have to have standards.
Christmas. Well, we can't
draw the line.
Although there are some places where you have to say Happy Holidays and everything. I mean, let me start there. Is this sort of a pushback against the what we hear is a war on Christmas, or at the very least, a minimizing of the importance of Christmas?
A little bit. I would say this is a demonstration against the war on Christmas in a small way.
Do you have a hashtag to go along with it? Because you have to have a hashtag if you're doing
No, we don't. But yeah, it's very ecumenical. We have three of the contributors to this book are Jewish.
I saw that. Jonah Goldberg is lecturing me on Christmas. This is good to know.
Well, no, this is why. Actually, Jonah writes the chapter about the war on Christmas, because I thought if I have a Christian doing that, it looks like I'm stacking the deck.
Good call.
So if I have one of my Jewish buddies do this, then he looks like he's a UN observer. He's totally impartial. he's just reporting the facts on the ground.
Exactly. That's a great idea. And by the way, I mean, Jonah Goldberg is just one of our favorite writers that you'll see here. Christopher Buckley, P.J. O'Rourke. What did PJ write about?
So PJ wrote Defending the Commercialization of Christmas. I never knew PJ had this in him. It is a very close biblical reading about the biblical injunctions about commerce. My favorite act is he goes through an exercise where he takes the gold, myrrh, and frankincense that were given to the infant Jesus, and then he then does this conversion up from denarii through like Roman history to modern day dollars.
Oh,
and
wow.
Says that Jesus was given roughly like $19 million for his birthday. So you have to understand that Jesus was a rich kid.
Yeah,
they, you know, when his parents,
fled
to Egypt, they were not staying in tent cities. They were at like the Marrakesh Hilton.
Only P.J. O'Rourke. And I'm sure he got an imprimatur from the local bishop on that story.
Yeah. All of the chapters in this book, they seem to come together and tell one story when you read them in total. What's the story that you want people to take away?
You know, the story I want people to take from this is that Christmas, I think there's a temptation to believe that Christmas is just a holiday for kids, but it isn't. Superficially, it is. Kids love Christmas. Everybody loves Santa. Everybody loves presents. Yeah, but as you get older, Christmas doesn't become dull. It doesn't become routine, because it's only as an adult that you can really, really understand what's so great about it, and that every year you get older, you actually should grow to appreciate Christmas and love it a little bit more.
Well, and I'm often lectured. You know, we just came in with Jingle Bell Rock, which is a nice secular, you know, let's all dance around the Christmas tree kind of thing, and there's no mention of, you know, the meaning of Christmas. But so... I often try to push back against that and say, no, you know, let's talk about the religiosity here. But at the same time, if I celebrate the gift-giving aspect of Christmas, and which I think is a wonderful thing, my ultra-religious friends push back at me and say, that's not the reason for the season. Well, gift-giving is just as important, is it not, in terms of the virtue of this season?
We three kings gave gifts.
Thank
if it was
you.
Good enough for the Christ child, it was good enough for me. But, you know, interestingly enough, so the war on Christmas actually dates back, you know, hundreds of years. So there was a war on Christmas in Puritan England, war on Christmas here in early colonial times. And it was precisely for that sort of thing. It was the Protestants who thought that the Christmas celebration, especially the gift-giving, was a real Catholic trappings of popery, is what they said. And so they wanted to be much more solemn, you know, not especially joyful, not a lot of presents and gift-giving and drinking and swilling of eggnog.
Are we correct, though, in the perception that there's been this explosion on whatever you want to call it? I'm not a huge fan of the term war on Christmas anyway, but whatever the pushback is against from the secular community against Christmas, is it your sense that it's really been that it's blown up in the last couple of years?
Yeah. My wife and I joke. We call it the global war on Christmas.
I think it's rendition and waterboarding involved.
No, you see this.
Right.
So every year there's this kabuki where, you know, some conservative says, you know, hey, there's a war on Christmas. And the left all go, oh, no, you're crazy. There's no war on Christmas. And I would say it is a metaphorical war, like the war on poverty. Yeah, but it's a real war in the same way that the war on poverty actually entailed real things. And when you look around, you know, it's not like we had this big flap of the Starbucks cups a few weeks ago. Do you remember that?
Which was entirely
manufactured. As far as I can tell, there's not a single Christian anywhere in America except for one guy on Facebook who was really upset about the Starbucks.
I think Starbucks was behind it. knowing their marketing.
Maybe, maybe not. But what's interesting, when you went to Twitter, looked at the hashtag for that, is looking at all the people who, on the left, were eager for it to have been a war on Christmas. So you couldn't find any, you couldn't find any Christians complaining, but you could find a lot of people on the secular left saying, yeah, we ought to stick it to them. Yeah.
The only things I saw on my Facebook feed were from people, my friends who are Christians, saying, this is why you shouldn't be that worried about it.
Right.
Yeah, I think there's something to say. And that's what Jonah says. Jonah says, look, I mean, it's important to push back against these things. Because the truth is, if you look just around the country, wherever there's a community where somebody files a lawsuit to make the fire department take down its Christmas tree that it's had on the front lawn for 55 years, the communities that push back against this almost always win. It's only the communities that just sort of, you know, run away in fear that lose. So it's important to push back against it. But on the other hand, you can't let them take the joy out of it. You don't want to become the person who's digging in for trench warfare in the war on Christmas.
Right. The last thing you want to be during Christmas time is joyless in fighting against people who are trying to remove Christmas from the public square. Well, let's throw some calls in here at 888-630-9625. Where do you think we are right now in terms of how Christmas is celebrated in America? Have we lost sight of the Christmas virtues, to rename the book here by Jonathan Lass, or at least to reiterate the name of the book, The Christmas Virtues? Have we lost sight of those virtues? What do you think are the most virtuous aspects of Christmas? And if you see some continuing creep of secularism taking hold and pushing Christmas out of the public squares, we want to hear your examples. Give us a call, 888-630-WMAL. The school of thought is that the war on Christmas, if it was such as it is, that it's been pushed back enough against right now, and it's sort of starting to quell. However, I just saw this thing, and I think it is a big deal. Malls around the country now, where they used to have Santa, and they still have Santa. Thank God they have Santa there at the mall. You know, I was ready for, you know, some just jolly fellow named something else to take a picture with.
An electrician.
Yeah, yeah. There's Sam the electrician. He's got a beard. Take your picture. But they always used to have Christmas trees and presents and just all of the trappings that you would expect to be surrounding Santa Claus. And I've seen now, and it's got to be consistent, and it's got to be thought through, multiple malls have used this white snow glacier setting. It's just Santa sitting on a glacier with no Christmas trappings. That ain't Christmas. It's not about...
At least they still have Santa.
Yeah, I mean, now.
That's the next step, I suppose.
Santa on an iceberg, right?
Disney's Santa on Ice, by the way, is a fantastic show, and I highly recommend it. But that's... all right, your call's in a moment. Jonathan Lass stays with us. We're going to talk about the Christmas virtues, some of the other stories in here by some of your favorite writers. And get the book, Christmas Virtues at the Treasury of Conservative Killer of the Holidays.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall, 5 to 9, Monday through Friday, only on 105.9 FM, WMAL. You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
Grandma got run over by a reindeer.
See now, this is not... Was this in this scene? Was it in Luke? Was that?
this? I know a lot about Luke, and I don't recall this being in there.
We're talking about the Christmas virtues, a treasury of conservative tales for the holidays. But I got, and our guest Jonathan Lass is in studio. I keep bringing up biblical references, but there's a lot in the book that has, because Christmas goes beyond the Christ story. It does. So you the virtues are not just the religious virtues.
Oh yeah, no. We start out by talking about Christmas trees and the whole rigmarole about getting a Christmas tree and the sending out of Christmas cards and the terrible inhuman people who send out those 10-page family letters who are just
inhuman.
The worst.
They do. They hate the baby Jesus.
They hate the baby Jesus and all that's good in the world.
James and Annandale, you're first up on WMAL. Are you seeing this this creep of removing the spirit from the Christmas season, James?
Absolutely. Because I was just thinking about this the other day. I was listening... I'm not going to mention the station, but certain stations like Thanksgiving, they start playing Christmas music, but they never play like, "Oh, come all ye faithful, joy to the world," which, you know, I mean, the lyrics of God the Father now in flesh appearing, you know, and that's the true meaning of Christmas. Uh-huh. And that, I mean, do they not play those songs because they're worried about the flack from the left or what?
It's a weird one, James. It's a great point. I mean, Jonathan Lass, they're going all in on Christmas music, so they're recognizing the season, but then the songs are, you know, like Grandma got run over by a reindeer.
Yeah.
So the biggest selling Christmas song of the last 30 years is the Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You.
Right.
And there's an interesting, actually, piece of this is talked about in our book, the chapters by Andy Ferguson. These songwriters said absolutely, you know, just openly, that this was a song about dating that they just glossed a little Christmas gilding onto. There's no real reason this is a Christmas song. And then that was an excuse to put Mariah Carey, who then was in her fighting prime,
yes,
into, you know, her little red Santa
yes,
suit,
sexy
for the
Santa,
sexy
elf
Santa for the for the video.
I remember.
And I would say it's very telling.
I bet you do.
I remember it vividly.
So it's very telling that this is the big selling Christmas song over the last 30 years. This is what people come to, and has no actual Christmas content.
But maybe there's the idea is you don't have to be Christian to appreciate Christmas.
I think that's
which
right.
Is a
and
nice
that's
thing, right?
Yeah.
But you know what, James and Annandale, this is just for you. We bucked the trend here on WMAL. This is actually. Yeah. I love this song. It's my favorite. I have a favorite secular Christmas song, and I have a favorite religious Christmas song, and this
What's
is
your
my favorite,
favorite secular one.
That would be Sleigh Ride. I sing it all year long.
But see, that's exactly though what we're getting at here about Christmas music, because technically that's not a Christmas song.
No,
that's
a winter
song,
right? Yeah.
And there's no differentiation between what Christmas songs are and winter songs.
The reason why I love O Come All Ye Faithful not only is it because it's beautiful and people know the Latin, which is kind of fun, but as a Catholic, this is always the entrance song at the midnight mass. Mm. It's like when you hear that song, it means it's now officially Christmas.
Wow.
This is it just gives me, I'm getting the warm feeling now. Todd in Silver Spring, you're next up on WMAL. If you were wondering why I'm, you know, the way I am, it's that warm feeling.
I don't wonder at all.
Todd here on WMAL.
We love that warm feeling, by the way.
Thank you, Todd.
two quick points. Good morning to you. I don't care about, I just went to Starbucks. I don't need Starbucks to tell me about Christmas. So whatever they want to do with their cups is fine by me. And then secondly, I'm the youngest of five kids, and I grew up in a religious household, but obviously Christmas was awesome, and being the youngest of five and Santa Claus and everything, it was really sad and disappointing for me when everybody else had left the nest and I was by myself. And so I'm raising our kids, or my wife and I are raising our kids, and we celebrate Christmas, but really with a much more emphasis on the Jesus side, because there's no disappointment there. Jesus doesn't disappoint me ever, and I think that that's a good lesson, at least in my life, that for me, that if I focus on that, I'm never disappointed.
Very nice to hear that, Todd.
That's
very
great.
Well put, yeah. The book, again, is The Christmas Virtues. That's the kind of virtue we're talking about, right?
Yeah, you know, and in fact, the chapter in the book about Jesus is by Kirsten Powers, who's not conservative. She's a liberal. I think she's many conservatives' favorite liberal in the world.
Right.
She certainly is mine.
But certainly informed by her Christianity.
Right. Well, and this is what's so interesting. So she's a very recent convert to Christianity,
yes,
and a really, really recent convert to Catholicism. Just a few weeks ago, she converted to Catholicism.
I read that. Yeah.
And so she writes about what it is like having your first Christmas with Jesus come at a very at late adult age.
Oh.
And it's a beautiful, beautiful chapter, and really I would, this is the type of, if you get the book, I think you'll love it, but this her chapter is the type of thing that you'll come back to every year.
Well, that right there is a reason to get this book. You sold me on it. The Christmas Virtues, A Treasury of Conservative Tales for the Holidays. The author is Jonathan Last.
You've been listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.